If you honestly, legitimately cannot remember it, then
I didn't do that.
Okay, okay.
Are you okay, Dennis?
No. No, I'm not. Do that.
You ready to go back?
Yeah.
All right.
Before we can break down the rest of this interrogation, we need to start about 38 years earlier. On Thursday, September 11th, 1980, at around 11:30 a.m., Norfolk law enforcement receive a phone call from two friends visiting a woman at her residence. As the call connects, there appears to be some sort of malfunction, as the friends making the call could clearly hear the dispatcher, but the dispatcher could not hear them at all. The two friends then knock on the neighbor's door and frantically explain that they had just found their friend deceased inside her home, and then they asked if they could please use their landline to dial 911. Officers immediately headed on their way to the house, and once they arrived, they examined every entryway as well as the condition of each room. As they reached the bedroom, they made a tragic discovery. They found 25-year-old Kathleen Doyle, deceased, lying in her bed. Her bedroom was a complete mess, with cushions, clothing, and furniture tossed in every direction. Kathleen was discovered with her hands tied behind her back, and what appeared to be an extension cord wrapped around her neck. She was also found with several bruises to her face and body, a stab mark on her chest and back, and a large circular burn on her left cheek. The size of this burn was compared to the size of a cigar. They had also found several indications that Kathleen had likely been sexually assaulted, so officers kept any items that they believed may contain bodily fluid from the suspect. The rest of the house appeared to be in near-perfect condition, without anything knocked over or ransacked. There also wasn't any signs of forced entry, no marks around the door frame, no tampering with any locks, as well as no broken or pried open windows. This indicated to investigators that this was likely a targeted attack and Kathleen was not a victim of circumstance at the hands of possible burglars or thieves. A more thorough examination of Kathleen's injuries, as well as the condition of the house, went underway and lasted approximately 5 days. And unfortunately, law enforcement found themselves without any immediate leads. They did, however, determine that Kathleen had likely been deceased for about 48 hours before her discovery, and that the phone in her living room, the same phone her friends initially tried to dial 911 with, had been tampered with and had the microphone removed. The case quickly went cold, as technology was not advanced enough quite yet to make any important forensic identifications. Nor was the evidence pointing towards any specific co-worker, neighbor, ex-boyfriend, friend, or family member. About 5 years later, a man named Henry Lee Lucas was in the midst of confessing to a series of other murders around the time that Kathleen was killed. These officers then pressed him regarding the possibility that he may have been Kathleen's killer. Although this case began to feel as if it was coming to a close, another curveball was thrown the investigators' way. Henry Lee Lucas was convicted of murdering his mother in 1960, and two others in 1983. However, Henry rose to infamy while incarcerated for these crimes when he falsely confessed to approximately 600 other murders. And as it turns out, this infamous and prolific serial killer was not involved in the murder of Kathleen at all. Nor was he involved in any of the other cases that he had confessed to. Instead, he was actually just making these stories up as he went along. The case of Henry Lee Lucas went famous in the recent Netflix documentary, The Confession Killer. But in the case of Kathleen Doyle, investigators were now back at square one. About 33 years later, the cold case of Kathleen Doyle resurfaced due to astonishing advancements in forensic science and technology, which drastically improved the odds of resolving these older cases. Norfolk County then assigns Detective Jonathan Smith to the case. The first thing that Jonathan Smith decided to look into was genetic genealogy. Basically, genetic genealogy is the combination of genetic analysis using DNA with traditional historical and genealogical research to study a person's family history. This process has been commercialized over the past two decades as a means to uncover unknown family history, leading to the massive growth of companies like Ancestry.com. For forensic investigations, this same technology can be used to identify partially decomposed remains. This is done by linking the DNA to a family tree that includes a missing person or a person who had not been seen in years that may have been living an itinerant lifestyle. This same process can be used to narrow down a list of suspects. In this case, that would mean that investigators would submit any DNA discovered at the crime scene, with the hopes to make a connection with a possible relative of the suspect, or even directly to the suspect. About a year after his assignment, on November 4th, 2019, Jonathan Smith submits the sheets collected from Kathleen's bed to be tested using this process. The results arrive fairly quickly, and investigators are presented with a long list of family relatives that could match the DNA provided. They then did a search of each name in the list, each name providing a near-clear result, except for one name. This specific name came back with a very colorful history of previous offenses, ranging from attempted murder to abduction to even sexual assault. 39 years after the assault and murder of Kathleen Doyle, investigators finally had a person of interest. This is Dennis Lee Bowman. Within the days of making these discoveries and connections to Dennis Lee Bowman, Detective Smith obtains the arrest warrant needed to bring Dennis in for an interrogation. Since Dennis was now residing in Michigan, Michigan law enforcement made the arrest and escorted him back to the police station. Once he was seated for questioning, Dennis remained completely silent except for the question, "Why am I here?" Officers then explained that he was facing charges for first-degree murder. Dennis then said something along the lines of, "That is BS. Get me a lawyer." Dennis then buckled down and remained completely silent until being escorted to a cell. He remained in custody for 2.5 months until he was finally extradited back to Virginia, where he was facing these charges. Upon his arrival, Dennis immediately began asking to speak to the detective in charge of the case. Since Dennis would be appointed counsel in 2 days, Detective Smith rushes to the police department to conduct this interview ASAP. As the two sit down, Dennis proves to be quite persuasive.
You want her to talk to me?
Yes, sir, I do. Why don't we make this thing real easy, okay? Easy for you, easy for me.
Okay.
Is there any way we can get capital knocked off?
Well.
Now, this is what I'm suggesting. I'll forego the lawyer. I will tell you everything that I have remembered from that night. And I will go before the judge and plead guilty of my own volition. Do you think we could do that?
Now, I can't answer that question without having the prosecutor present and without having your attorney present. Now, you're going
to
be...
Well, what if I don't have an attorney? What if I don't choose not to have one?
So,
more or less turn myself in.
So, if I understand you correctly, Dennis, you want to just do something along the lines of going to court Monday... saying,
I did it.
Dennis continues to attempt to talk his charges down. However, Detective Smith makes it very clear that he cannot make any promises and that the death sentence will still be on the table. Reluctantly, Dennis agrees to continue talking.
I understand. Things bottom up.
Well, yeah.
Fueled your aggression, right? And that's what I'd like to talk to you more about, Dennis. For those instances and what was going through your mind here in Norfolk in September of 1980.
Okay. Then I will tell you exactly what happened.
Okay.
First of all, that was the period of which I go to the 2 weeks for service.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 600 miles away from anybody I know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wound up like an 8-day clock. I said, okay, I got to get off this ship.
Right.
And I walked into a little bar. Well, I got stupid drunk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just crazy stupid drunk. I sat there for about, I'll bet, 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know how I was going to get back to base.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't afford a cab or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's night. And I'm walking down the street, and I walked past this house, and I said, I wonder if they got some of this money ran around. And I went up to a window, got out a pocket knife, but got it open, opened up the window. I almost fell in the house. I was drunk. I mean, I was just drunk. And I looked in the top drawers, because everybody's got a junk drawer.
Right.
There was another door, and opened it up, and she was lying there. Sat up and started to scream. I still had that little pen knife in my hand.
Right.
And when I went to push her back down, she grabbed that hand. I can see it right in my mind, that knife going right there. I blanked out right there. And I said, lady, I'm leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked out the front room.
Do you remember having sex with her?
Mm. In fact, I don't know how I ever had sex with her. I was drunk as a skunk.
Right. Do you remember if you tied her up at all?
No, I don't know that either.
Despite admitting to the intrusion and harm of Kathleen, Dennis creates a pattern of avoidance, holding himself back from mentioning some major details. Up until this point, Dennis has claimed that he had blacked out a majority of the incident, including tying Kathleen up, burning her, and sexually assaulting her. So as a way to test his memory, Detective Smith asks Dennis to draw a diagram of Kathleen's house. Dennis continues to draw this floor plan with incredible accuracy, beyond what is expected. He then begins to speak about something he referred to as the demon.
And you want to describe it to me as you're going along?
It's
okay.
There's a door there.
Okay.
Not in this room. In the living room. She's right there. As soon as I open the door. Right there is where everything happened. Yes, Dennis.
Mm-hmm.
And the demon used to be right out here in front.
Right.
Had a little pointed beard. Horns.
Mm-hmm.
Claws. But now, the demon's in here. And it still tries to get out. The demon.
At this point, Dennis is now proclaiming that the demon took over, and during the moments that he could not remember, the demon was in control.
I can see her. I can see her stomach.
All right, so she obviously didn't have any clothes on.
No, she had clothes on.
Well, she must not have had clothes on here.
Well,
if you could see her stomach.
I don't know. Maybe you're. I don't know. I know she was wearing a nightgown.
Okay.
And that's when I blanked out. I remember when I left.
All right, let's stop for a second.
I don't remember.
Don't remember having sex with her. Is that something you normally forget?
Not normally, no. But this was not normal. This was when I was extremely upset, and I broke.
All right, and I know it was 40 years ago. I get it. I didn't tell you everything I did 25, 30 years ago on a specific day, right? So I get that. I get there.
It all depends on the day.
Oh, you're right. And the event. And I'm glad you said that because this was a very, very traumatic event for her family, for you, okay? You're giving me the story, but you're also leaving out things, all right? It has to be believable, all right, to everybody involved.
I didn't do that.
Give me a couple minutes, Dennis.
I didn't do that.
While Detective Smith takes a break from the room, he mentions his disbelief of Dennis's story to the other officers. In doing so, he mentions that he doesn't believe that Dennis ever planned to fully admit to the crimes he committed. At the same time, Dennis remained in the interrogation room, stirring in his own state of disbelief. Dennis Lee Bowman was then escorted back to his cell while he awaited his court proceedings.
Bowman was also arrested in 1998, accused of breaking into a co-worker's home to steal lingerie. And this private investigator I spoke to believes there are even more victims out there.
I think there's a lot more to this story than what's just coming out. I think he's probably responsible for several other, you know, abductions or murders or, you know, crimes. I really do.
70-year-old Dennis Bowman was arrested in November for the 1980 murder of Kathleen Doyle in Norfolk, Virginia. But even before this arrest, there were suspicions that he was somehow involved in the 1989 disappearance of his adopted daughter, Andrea. Though she remains missing, Bowman has never been charged in her disappearance.
If you kind of look at the circumstances, it seems like he's probably a habitual offender.
When looking through Bowman's criminal history, there is just a single reference to his adopted and still missing daughter in the case file for a 1998 arrest. Bowman was being sentenced on a breaking and entering charge and wrote a letter to the judge in the case. In it, he says, "I am the father of two lovely daughters, one 25 and the other 11, and feel that being a parent is one of the most important and sobering things a person can undertake."
While in custody, another gruesome discovery was made after Dennis Lee Bowman decided to confess to his ex-wife about the murder of their missing adopted daughter, Andrea, in 1989.
Brenda. Why, Brenda? Andrea was buried in our backyard. If you look back towards the concrete in the backyard, she's underneath the left-hand side of that in a cardboard bowl.
Oh, my God.
She's been with us all along. So now here it is. Now you know where she is. At least you'll have her in a tin jar on a shelf. Now you know I'm a rotten, stinking son of a bitch.
On February 4th, 2020, law enforcement officers uncovered skeletal remains in the 3200 block of 136th Avenue in Monterey Township, near Bowman's home. These remains were quickly identified as Andrea. Deputies stated that Dennis confessed to confronting and striking his daughter, which caused her to lose her balance and fall. They also stated that Dennis admitted to never calling for help, and then dismembering her body with an axe and machete before disposal. Dennis Lee Bowman went on to receive two life sentences for the murder of Kathleen Doyle. He was then facing four more charges: open murder, felony murder, first-degree child abuse, and mutilation of a body. All of these charges pertaining to the murder of Andrea.
Dennis Lee Bowman will be pleading no contest to murder in the second degree as a habitual offender second offense notice. That is a felony level charge and a life offense.
This moment has been a long time coming. Andrea Bowman disappeared all the way back in 1989. Her adoptive father filing a missing persons report, but always denying any involvement in what happened to her.
Do you understand, Mr. Bowman, that a no contest plea will result in a conviction, will be found guilty by the court?
Yes, ma'am.
He punched her in the face at the top of the stairs. She fell backwards down the stairs.
Bowman admitted that he eventually put Andrea's body into a cardboard barrel, burying her in a 3-foot-deep hole under a slab of cement on their Hamilton property. Police would finally uncover her remains during the execution of a search warrant in February 2020.
Andrea's remains identified using a DNA and a comparison with her biological mother's, Kathy Tarkanian.
The girl's biological mom, Kathy Tarkanian, has been instrumental in keeping the public attention on Andrea's case. On Wednesday, she told Fox 17, "I'm sad, but relieved he finally told the truth. It's been a very long, difficult journey, but I did it all because I love Alexis." Alexis being the name she gave Andrea at birth before giving her up for adoption.
Dennis Lee Bowman was then found guilty of all counts and sentenced to an additional 35 to 50 years behind bars without the possibility of parole.